could go for that. VOA won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn. Then, because the third Monday in February in the United States is President's Day, Kelly Jean Kelly will have a special presentation of America's Presidents on the Office of the President. And later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a British math expert says all the COVID-causing virus that currently exists in the world could easily fit inside a single can of soda. The finding shows just how much damage can be caused by very small virus particles. Christian Yates of the University of Bath studied worldwide rates of new COVID-19 infections and made estimates of the amount of virus in an infected person's blood. He found that there are about 2 quintillion or 2 billion billion SARS-CoV-2 virus particles in the world at any one time. Yates said he came up with that result by measuring the distance across one virus particle, about 100 nanometers or 100 billionths of a meter. He then found the total amount of space the virus takes up. He said the total is still less than can be contained in a single 330 milliliter soda can. He noted that total includes the fact that the particles will leave a lot of space in between when placed together. It's astonishing to think that all the trouble, the disruption, the hardship, and the loss of life that has resulted over the last year could constitute just a few mouthfuls, Yates said in a report on his findings. More than 2.3 million people have died in the COVID-19 pandemic so far. There have been about 107 million confirmed cases worldwide.
Scientists have created a new map that aims to identify the best sources of water on Mars. Water is considered a critical resource to support future exploration activities on Mars. Scientists believe the Red Planet contains large amounts of water. But searching from Earth for the best supplies is not easy. The American space agency NASA has worked for years to identify the best spots for such water. Most of the water on Mars exists as ice because of extremely cold temperatures. A new study describes and provides detailed mapping for the most likely areas to contain water ice. The study appeared recently in Nature Astronomy. It is part of a project called Subsurface Water Ice Mapping, or SWIM. NASA says the SWIM project combines 20 years of data collected by several of the agency's Mars explorers. Researchers at the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona, are leading the research with support from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. Gareth Morgan is a scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and helped lead the research. He said in a statement, "The goal of SWIM is to provide maps of potential buried ice deposits to support the selection of human landing sites." He added that Mars ice is a critical resource that could be used for many things, including providing drinking water for humans, growing plants for food, and producing methane fuel and breathable air. But the most important is to provide fuel for the return trip home to Earth, Morgan said. Researchers have already experimented with methods that could use water ice on Mars to produce fuel as well as oxygen. Richard Davis leads NASA's efforts to find resources on Mars in preparation for sending humans to the Red Planet. He said the identification of water sources on Mars could also help in the search for life, which would likely be found near the water. The next frontier for Mars is for human explorers to get below the surface and look for signs of microbial life, Davis said. NASA says most scientists and engineers believe the most reachable subsurface ice exists below polar areas of Mars in the northern hemisphere. The new map centered on these areas south of the polar area but north of the equator because they hold more favorable conditions for humans. Spacecraft landings would also be easier there. The map identifies two specific areas on Mars where subsurface ice could likely be found. The first sits among plains in an area known as Arcadia Planitia. Scientists believe the area was formed by ancient volcanic flows. The other contains glacier-filled lowlands in an area called Deuteronalis Mensae. The study identified the areas using five different methods that examined data sets from past Mars explorers. They included NASA's Mars Odyssey, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and the Mars Global Surveyor. The process was not designed to measure water ice directly, Gareth Morgan explained. Instead, it was meant to predict the probability of ice supplies based on observed conditions. He said things such as high levels of hydrogen and high radar wave speeds can suggest that ice is present. NASA says it plans to use the new research to prepare for discussions with top experts to examine possible human landing areas on Mars. NASA also recently announced it had signed an agreement with international partners to develop a future robotic Mars mapping mission to search for water ice. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are not going to talk about any one president. We will instead talk about the presidency itself, what some people call the office of the presidency. That does not mean the room where the leader of the United States works. Here, it means the position and powers of the U.S. president. Sidney Milkus is part of the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He and others at the Miller Center are specialists on U.S. political history. Milkus says that when it was created in the late 1700s, the U.S. presidency was unlike any other position in world history.
For thousands of years before the American Constitution, people thought a strong executive power and a democracy, what Jefferson called self-government, were incompatible. Because how could a sovereign, a people, delegate tremendous responsibility to one individual and still consider themselves a democracy, even a representative democracy?
In other words, the idea of giving a lot of power to one person made sense if the country were a monarchy and ruled by a king or queen. And giving a lot of power to an elected group in a legislature made sense if the country were a democracy and voters elected representatives. But giving a lot of power to one person in a democracy did not seem to make sense. The writers of the Constitution understood this situation. They were concerned about giving one person too much power. Remember, the country's founders had just fought a war for independence against the British. The American colonists had not liked being under the control of a British king. They also worried that a strong executive could become a tyrant or corrupt, adds Harry Rubinstein. He is a curator at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. But the Constitution's writers had also seen the problems of a weak executive branch. Asking state legislatures to make national decisions took too long, and sometimes the problems were never resolved at all. Historian Sidney Milkus says that, as a result of these ideas, some of them conflicting, the writers of the Constitution argued about what the office of the president should be.
There were people like James Madison and Jefferson who thought the president's power should be limited, and the term president meant preside, and Congress and the state should be the leading venues of American democracy.
Other people who helped write the U.S. Constitution, such as Alexander Hamilton, thought the president should be what Milkus calls the anchor of American democracy. Hamilton thought the president should have enough power to direct large projects for the public good. So what happened? Well, in 1787, delegates to the Constitutional Convention found a unique solution. First, they agreed to make the president a one-person job. One person, they reasoned, could both make decisions more effectively than a group and be more easily held responsible for them. But they decided not to give the president too much power. The person would be elected for 1 4-year term at a time, and the president would share power with a national legislature and a Supreme Court. The delegates also decided some of the details about how the president would be elected and how to remove the person from office. And they said the president would have a number of duties. They include being the commander-in-chief of the military, nominating public officials, and giving Congress a report on the State of the Union. This list comes from Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. But a lot of the job description was left open. It said, "The president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed." Since it was written in 1787, that expression has informed discussions about what powers the U.S. president should really have. Historian Sidney Milkus says Americans are still debating how much power the president should have. For most of the 19th century, he says, the powers of the president were more limited. But since the 20th century, the position has become more powerful. the president has moved closer to the center of American democracy. But in time, Milka says, Americans may decide to limit the president's authority again and give more power to Congress and state governments. Milkus adds one more thing about the unusual invention of the U.S. president. It was unclear that the public would trust a national executive, but as our America's President series shows, for the most part, Americans respect the office of the president. Instead of fearing our great leaders, says Milkus, we honor them. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the middle of the 1930s, America seemed to be moving out of the worst depression in its history. Most people supported the New Deal policies of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The dark view that many Americans held during the final days of President Herbert Hoover's administration seemed to be changing. People began to believe that the United States was facing its problems with energy and hope. Harry Monroe and Jack Weitzel tell more about the New Deal programs of President Roosevelt.
The change could be seen in the way that Americans were moving away from extreme political movements of both the right and the left. Many decided that the best solution was to work through the existing political system. Most importantly, Roosevelt's continued experiments with different programs showed Americans that they did not have to blindly follow political or economic traditions. For years, most Americans had accepted the basic ideas of traditional free market capitalism. But as the Depression began, a small number of Americans became interested in the economic ideas of Karl Marx. Roosevelt believed it was best to travel a path between these two opposite ideas. He basically supported the free market system, but he believed government also had a right and responsibility to act when needed, and he supported new government controls in such important areas as banking, transportation, agriculture, and oil production.
Some Americans did not think it was wise or even possible to mix traditional free market capitalism with government intervention or socialism. Former Republican Treasury Secretary Ogden Mills put it this way: "We can have a free country or a socialist one. We cannot have both. Our economic system cannot be half free and half socialistic. There is no middle ground between governing and being governed, between absolute rule and freedom." Many leftists and socialists agreed with conservatives that it was impossible to mix capitalism and socialism. One leftist publication wrote, "Either the nation must live with the sadness of capitalism, or it must prepare to replace capitalism with socialism. There is no longer a practical middle path. However, Roosevelt and his New Dealers happily rejected these arguments. They aimed the country between rightist and leftist extremes and created a whole new set of rules for government, the economy, and democracy.
Most Americans supported Roosevelt and the Democrats as they experimented with new solutions to the problems of the Depression. They elected Democrats to a large majority in Congress in 1934. 2 years later, they re-elected Franklin Roosevelt to a second term in the White House by one of the largest victories in American history. Roosevelt's big victory made him stronger than ever, so he decided to fight the part of the government that had been blocking many of his programs, the Supreme Court.
Most of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court in 1936 were conservative. They had ruled that many of Roosevelt's most important New Deal programs were illegal. Now, the judges were preparing to decide the future of programs to help old people, labor unions, and others. And there was nothing the president could do under the American system of government. So, Roosevelt called for changes in the system. He asked Congress to reorganize the federal judicial system, and he asked for the power to add several new members to the Supreme Court. In this way, Roosevelt hoped to gain a new majority on the court that would support his views.
Most Americans liked Roosevelt, but people of all opinions feared that the president was trying to destroy the careful system of checks and balances in the federal government. They agreed with him in opposing the court's decisions, but they accepted the right of Supreme Court judges to rule as they thought correct. For this reason, the nation rejected Roosevelt's plan to add new members to the court.
Roosevelt's unsuccessful effort to change the Supreme Court came at the same time as the economy began to get worse. Many Americans thought they had defeated the Depression in 1935 and 36. There was steady economic improvement. Some bankers had even begun to fear that the economy was growing too fast. These bankers called on the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, to control the expanding money supply. And the Federal Reserve acted to limit the amount of money in use. At the same time, the federal government began reducing the amount of money that it was spending, and it launched the new Social Security tax on workers' incomes. The effect of all these government actions was to limit the amount of money being spent by the government, companies, and private citizens. As a result, the economy began to fall once again into depression.
In August 1937, stock market prices began to fall sharply. In 7 months, the price of stock for the General Motors Corporation fell from $60 to $25. The United States Steel Company stock fell all the way from $121 to $38. In fact, the stock markets lost in 9 months about two-thirds of all the gains that they had made so slowly and painfully since Roosevelt took office. Americans had supported Roosevelt's New Deal program because it offered a solution to the Depression. Now that program seemed to be failing.
Historian Frederick Lewis Allen remembered those dark days of 1937. Goods sold slowly, Allen wrote. Businessmen became frightened and reduced production. 2 million men were thrown out of work in the space of a few months. They became less able to buy what was for sale. The terrible circle of the falling value of the dollar moved all the more rapidly.
The new economic crisis hurt Roosevelt's popularity, and it came at a time when he faced growing opposition within his own Democratic Party. For several years, conservative Democrats from the southeastern part of the country had supported Roosevelt. They liked his leadership and the power that he brought to all Democrats. But they opposed many of his more liberal or experimental social policies.
As the economy and Roosevelt's popularity fell, many of these Southern Democrats began to openly oppose his leadership. They voted with Republicans on important bills before Congress. Roosevelt became very angry about the new opposition from within his own party. He began to intervene personally in Democratic Party primary elections in 1938. He told party members in several states that they should only vote for candidates who would support his New Deal policies. Roosevelt's opponents accused him of interfering in local politics, and Democratic voters agreed with these criticisms. In almost all cases, they rejected the candidates supported by the president. A few months later, voters in the general election gave the Republicans major gains in both the House of Representatives and Senate.
In most situations, such a change in support would have signaled the end of a president's power. If people will not follow, a president cannot lead or be elected. But such was not the case for Roosevelt and the United States in the late 1930s. It was true that economic and political troubles were not solved, but another crisis was growing larger every day, making these other problems seem less and less important. The crisis was in foreign policy. Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party in Germany seemed ready to make war on Europe, and Japanese forces appeared to be planning new aggression in the Pacific. Americans could no longer just worry about their problems at home. A dark cloud was forming outside their door.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.